Romans' help to perform the confirming chemistry. In the heat of Roman August, they looked for additional clear-cut examples and won a double prize. We also found a second case of proven radiative capture, Amaldi writes, which was based on the discovery of a new radioisotope of aluminum with a lifetime of almost 3 minutes. Fermi planned to stop off in London for an international physics conference on his way home from South America. His young colleagues sent him word of their aluminum discovery. He reported to the conference on the neutron work. Szilard also attended, happy to hear praise for his summer experiments and well-launched toward a paying fellowship at Oxford. Fermi said his group had studied 60 elements so far and had induced radioactivity in 40 of them. Discussing the radiative capture problem, he cited the Cavendish results and those of Amaldi and Segre on aluminum, which were both, he said, to be considered particularly important. Segre describes the tempestuous aftermath. "Shortly afterwards, I caught a cold and could not go to the laboratory for several days. Amaldi tried to repeat our experiments and found a different half-life for irradiated aluminum, which showed that our so-called NY reaction, that is, neutron in, gamma photon out, did not occur. This was hurriedly relayed to Fermi, who resented having communicated a result which now looked to be an error. He strongly criticized us and did not conceal his displeasure. The whole business was becoming very troublesome because we could not find any fault with the various experiments, which gave inconsistent results." The chastened junior members had their work cut out for them. A new recruit joined them, a tall, broad-shouldered, handsome tennis champion from Pisa named Bruno Pontecorvo, as they set about polishing their first rough work. Neutron bombardment activated some elements more intensely than others. They had previously categorized that activation only generally as strong, medium, or weak. Now they proposed to establish a quantitative scale of activability. They needed some standard intensity against which to measure the intensity of other activations. They chose the convenient 2.3-minute half-life period that neutron bombardment induced in silver. Amaldi and Pontecorvo got the assignment. They immediately found, to their surprise, that their silver cylinders activated differently in different parts of the laboratory. In particular, writes Amaldi, there were certain wooden tables near a spectroscope in a dark room which had miraculous properties, since silver irradiated on those tables gained much more activity than when it was irradiated on a marble table in the same room. That was a mystery worth exploring. On October 18th, they started a systematic investigation, a series of measurements made inside and outside a lead housing. By October 22nd, they were prepared to measure what might happen when only a lead wedge separated the neutron source from its target. But the experimenters had to give student examinations that morning, and Fermi decided to go ahead on his own. He described the historic moment late in life to a colleague curious about the process of discovery in physics. "I will tell you how I came to make the discovery, which I suppose is the most important one I have made. We were working very hard on the neutron-induced radioactivity, and the results we were obtaining made no sense. One day, as I came into the laboratory, it occurred to me that I should examine the effect of placing a piece of lead before the incident neutrons. Instead of my usual custom, I took great pains to have the piece of lead precisely machined. I was clearly dissatisfied with something. I tried every excuse to postpone putting the piece of lead in its place. When, finally, with some reluctance, I was going to put it in place, I said to myself, 'No, I do not want this piece of lead here. What I want is a piece of paraffin.' It was just like that, with no advance warning, no conscious prior reasoning. I immediately took some odd piece of paraffin and placed it where the piece of lead was to have been. The extraordinary result of substituting paraffin wax for a heavy element like lead was a dramatic increase in the intensity of the activation. About noon, Segre remembers, Everybody was summoned to watch the miraculous effects of the filtration by paraffin. At first I thought a counter had gone wrong, because such strong activities had not appeared before. But it was immediately demonstrated that the strong activation resulted from the filtering by the paraffin of the radiation that produced the radioactivity. Laura Fermi says, "The halls of the physics building resounded with loud exclamations. Fantastic! Incredible! Black magic!" Not even his most important discovery kept Fermi from going home for lunch. He was alone. His wife and daughter would not return from a visit to the country until the following morning. He pondered in solitude and may have considered the difference between wood and marble tables, as well as between paraffin and lead. When he returned in mid-afternoon, he proposed an answer. The neutrons were colliding with the hydrogen nuclei in the paraffin and the wood. That slowed them down. Everyone had assumed that faster neutrons were better for nuclear bombardment because faster protons and alpha particles always had been better. But the analogy ignored the neutron's distinctive neutrality. A charged particle needed energy to push through the nucleus's electrical barrier. A neutron did not. Slowing down a neutron gave it more time in the vicinity of the nucleus, and that gave it more time to be captured. The simplest way to test Fermi's theory was to try some other material besides paraffin that contained hydrogen. Other light nuclei would also work to slow neutrons down, but hydrogen would work best. Its nuclei are protons, about the same size and mass as neutrons, and they therefore bounce hardest and soak up the most energy per collision. Down to the first floor and out the back door they marched with their silver cylinder and their neutron source extended in its long glass tube to the pond in Corbino's garden, where Rossetti had experimented with raising salamanders, where they had all caught the fad one summer of sailing candle-powered toy boats, where the dark, curving leaves and leathery gray droops of an almond tree shaded the lively goldfish. The hydrogen in water, and in goldfish, worked as well as paraffin. Back in the lab, they quickly tested whatever they could lay hands on to irradiate. Silicon, zinc, phosphorus, which did not seem to be affected by the slow neutrons. Copper, iodine, aluminum, which did. They tried radon without beryllium to make sure the paraffin was affecting neutrons and not gamma rays. They replaced the paraffin with an oxygen compound and found much less increase in induced radioactivity. They went home to make dinner, but met afterward at Amaldi's, whose wife had a typewriter, to prepare a first report. "Fermi dictated while I wrote," Segre remembers. "He stood by me." Rossetti, Amaldi, and Pontecorvo paced the room excitedly, all making comments at the same time. Laura Fermi recreates the scene. "They shouted their suggestions so loudly, they argued so heatedly about what to say and how to say it, they paced the floor in such audible agitation, they left the Amaldi's house in such a state that the Amaldi's maid timidly inquired whether the guests had all been drunk." Canestra Amaldi delivered the typed paper, "Influence of Hydrogenous Substances on the Radioactivity Produced by Neutrons, 1, to the director of the Ricerca Scientifica the next morning. Tucked away in its historic paragraphs was a quiet justification for the confusion over aluminum. "The case of aluminum is noteworthy. In water, it acquires an activity showing a period slightly shorter than 3 minutes. This activity, under normal conditions, is so weak that it almost disappears compared to other activities generated in the same element." Amaldi and Segre had not been wrong about aluminum. They had simply irradiated different samples of the element on different tables. The hydrogen in the wood table had slowed down some of the neutrons and enhanced the almost 3-minute activity. As Hans Bethe once noted wittily, the efficiency of slow neutrons might never have been discovered if Italy were not rich in marble. A marble table gave different results from a wooden table. If it had been done in America, it would all have been done on a wooden table and people would never have found out. The discovery of slow neutron radioactivity meant that Fermi's group had to work its way through the elements again, looking for different and enhanced half-lives, which is to say, different isotopes and decay products. While that work proceeded, a paper appeared in the Physical Review criticizing the group's earlier study of uranium. The paper's primary author was Aristide von Grosse, who had been one of Otto Hahn's assistants at the KWI and who had purified the first substantial sample of protactinium, the element Hahn and Meitner had discovered in 1917. Von Grosse argued that when Fermi irradiated uranium, he had created protactinium, atomic number 91, not a new transuranic element. The Rome group took the paper as a challenge to further experiment. At the same time, Hahn and Meitner decided proprietarily to repeat Fermi's previous uranium work. It was a logical decision, Hahn explains in his scientific autobiography. Having been the discoverers of protactinium, we knew its chemical characteristics. The increasing number of different half-lives that investigators in Berlin and Paris found when they irradiated uranium were puzzling. Hahn correctly felt that he was better qualified than anyone else in the world to accomplish the subtle radiochemistry necessary to sort everything out. In January and February 1935, in the midst of other projects, Amaldi set to work looking for alpha-emitting reactions in uranium in addition to the beta reactions the group had originally found. If uranium emitted alpha particles when it captured neutrons, it would be transmuting down the periodic table rather than up, which might indeed produce protactinium along the way. Amaldi chose to use an ionization chamber connected to a linear amplifier to capture and measure the radiation. "I began to irradiate some foils of uranium," he writes, "and put them immediately after irradiation in front of the thin window ionization chamber. Nothing happened. Conceivably, the half-lives were too brief for the run down the hall from the irradiation area to the ionization chamber. Amaldi decided to try irradiating his samples directly in front of the chamber. That required screening out unwanted radiation. The gamma rays from his neutron source, which would have disturbed the ionization chamber, he blocked by setting a piece of lead between the source and the chamber. The desirable neutrons would find the lead no obstacle. He wanted to filter out uranium's natural alpha background. To do that, he took advantage of the basic law of radioactivity, that shorter half-lives mean more energetic radiation. The half-life of natural uranium is about 4.5 billion years. Its alphas are proportionately mild, mild enough to be blocked by a layer of aluminum foil. On the other hand, if there really were half-lives in his experiment so short that he had to irradiate directly in front of the ionization chamber to catch them, their alphas should be energetic enough to breeze easily through the aluminum and the chamber window and enter the chamber for counting. So Amaldi wrapped his uranium samples with aluminum foil. It did not occur to him that his shielding might also screen out other reaction products. In 1935, alpha, beta, and gamma radiation were the only reaction products anyone knew. The experiments, Amaldi concludes, gave negative results. He found no artificially induced alphas from uranium. The Italians thought it even more probable then that by irradiating uranium, they were creating new man-made elements. Hahn and Meitner reported they thought so too. Fermi's group rounded up its work in the Proceedings of the Royal Society in a paper Rutherford approvingly passed along to that journal on February 15th. Through these experiments, our hypothesis that the 13-minute and 100-minute induced activities of uranium are due to transuranic elements seems to receive further support. The simplest interpretation consistent with the known facts is to assume that the 15-second, 13-minute, and 100-minute activities are chain products, that is, one decays into the next, probably with atomic number 92, 93, and 94 respectively, and atomic weight 239. But the truth was uranium was a confusion, and no one yet knew. "What else besides beryllium?" Leo Szilard asked himself in London. Beryllium looked suspicious. What other elements might chain react? He answered with an amended patent specification on April 9, 1935. Other examples for elements from which neutrons can liberate multiple neutrons are uranium and bromine. He was guessing, and without research funds, he saw no way to experiment. The physicists he talked to remained profoundly skeptical of his ideas. So I thought, there is, after all, something called chain reaction in chemistry. It doesn't resemble a nuclear chain reaction, but still, it's a chain reaction. So I thought I would talk to a chemist. The chemist he thought he would talk to was someone even more skillful than Leo Szilard at raising funds, Chaim Weizmann, who now lived and worked in London. Weizmann received Szilard and understood what I told him. He asked Szilard how much money he needed. Szilard said £2,000, about $10,000. Though he was certainly hard-pressed for funding himself, Weizmann said he would see what he could do. Szilard recalls, "I didn't hear from him for several weeks, but then I ran into Michael Polanyi, who by that time had arrived in Manchester and was head of the chemistry department there. Polanyi told me that Weizmann had come to talk to him about my ideas for the possibility of a chain reaction, and he wanted Polanyi's advice on whether he should get me this money. Polanyi thought that this experiment should be done." A decade passed before Szilard and Weizmann met again. A gulf of history. Weizmann had not neglected Szilard's request, he explained then in apology in late 1945. He had only not succeeded in raising the funds. Since the beginning of his rescue work in England, Szilard had been in occasional contact with the physicist Frederick Alexander Lindemann, who was professor of experimental philosophy at Oxford and director of the Clarendon Laboratory there. It was Lindemann, wealthy and well-connected, who was arranging a fellowship for Szilard, part of his continuing campaign to arm the decrepit Oxford Science Laboratory against its splendid Cambridge rival. Lindemann had made effective use in that campaign of the Nazi expulsion of the Jewish academics, but had given as good as he got. Immediately upon hearing of the civil service law, he had gone to Imperial Chemical Industries and convinced its directors to establish a grant program, arguing that such an investment would not be charity, but money well spent. ICI had already begun paying out its first grant on May 1, 1933, while Beveridge and Szilard were still laying plans. It was an ICI grant that Szilard missed winning the following August, perhaps because he had not yet accomplished his summer of impressive experiment at St. Bart's, but Lindemann was paying attention now. The tall, handsome Englishman, 49 years old in 1935, had been born in Germany, at Baden-Baden, because his mother chose not to allow advanced pregnancy to interfere with a visit to that fashionable spa. To provide their son with an outstanding education, his English parents had sent him to the gymnasium in Darmstadt. As a student before the Great War at the Darmstadt Technische Hochschule, where he was a protege of the physical chemist Walter Nernst, the 1920 chemistry Nobelist, he had enjoyed such exceptional family connections that he found himself at times playing tennis with the Kaiser or the Tsar. Inevitably, the war made suspect such golden afternoons. Lindemann was chagrined and angered in 1915 to find that the British Army, noting his German birth certificate and German-sounding name, was unwilling to extend him a commission. The Army's decision injured him deeply and may have changed his life. He had served as a co-secretary to the 1911 Solvay Conference, standing up proudly with Nernst, Rutherford, Planck, Einstein, Madame Curie, but even before that youthful apotheosis, Nernst had predicted difficulty. "If your father were not such a rich man," the blunt German had said, "you would become a great physicist." When the army questioned Lindemann's patriotism, writes a refugee colleague, he became withdrawn to avoid exposing himself to slights and insults. Secretiveness about his personal life developed into a mania, and he discouraged personal approaches by a standoffishness which was easily mistaken for arrogance. Lindemann retreated from original work and became a talented administrator. The prof, an unbending Victorian gentleman, always impeccable in bowler hat, summer gray suit, winter dark suit, rolled up umbrella, and long, dark coat. if he could not win a uniform, he would adopt one of his own. He worked for his country during the war at the Royal Aircraft Factory at Farnborough, designing what are now called avionics and doing aeronautical research. Tailspins were recognized maneuvers in air fighting by 1916, a good way to shake off an attacker. Lindemann was the first to study them scientifically. To do so, he took flying lessons, only changing from civilian clothes to flying clothes on the runway beside the plane, then coolly flew spin after spin, memorizing his instrument readings as he plummeted and writing them down after he had recovered level flight. After the war, Lindemann accepted appointment to an Oxford still donnishly disdainful of science. He escaped from that further condescension, says his colleague, into gracious living, enjoying weekends with a nobility that were seldom vouchsafed to less well-born Oxford dons. By then, a Rolls-Royce was part of his regalia. In June 1921, on a weekend at the country estate of the Duke and Duchess of Westminster, Lindemann met Winston Churchill, 12 years his senior. The two men, so different in background and character, took to each other immediately, and their acquaintance soon turned into a close friendship. Churchill recalled that he saw a great deal of Frederick Lindemann during the 1930s. Lindemann was already an old friend of mine. We came much closer from 1932 onwards, and he frequently motored over from Oxford to stay with me at Chartwell. Here we had many talks into the small hours of the morning about the dangers which seemed to be gathering upon us. Lindemann became my chief advisor on the scientific aspects of modern war. To this illustrious personage, a vegetarian who daily consumed copious quantities of olive oil and port salut, Szilard turned in the early summer of 1935 to discuss the question whether or not the liberation of nuclear energy can be achieved in the immediate future. If double neutrons could be produced, Szilard wrote Lindemann on June 3rd, then it is certainly less bold to expect this achievement in the immediate future than to believe the opposite. That meant trouble, Szilard thought, if Germany achieved a chain reaction first, and he argued for an attempt, whatever small chance of success it may have, to control this development as long as possible. Secrecy was the way to achieve such control. First, by winning agreement from the scientists involved to restrict publication, and second, by taking out patents. Michael Polanyi had cautioned Szilard late in 1934 that there is an opposition to you on account of taking patents. The British scientific tradition that opposed patents assumed that those who filed them did so for mercenary purposes. Szilard explained his patents to Lindemann to clear his name. Early in March last year, it seemed advisable to envisage the possibility that the release of large amounts of energy might be imminent. Realizing to what extent this hinges on the double neutron, I have applied for a patent along these lines. Obviously, it would be misplaced to consider patents in this field private property and pursue them with a view to commercial exploitation for private purposes. When the time is ripe, some suitable body will have to be created to ensure their proper use. For the time being, Szilard proposed to work at Oxford on finding his double neutrons, possibly raising £1,000 on the side from private persons, so that he could hire a helper or two. To bait Lindemann's Clarendon ambitions, he argued in conclusion that this type of work could greatly accelerate the building up of nuclear physics at Oxford, as indeed, had it gone forward, it might have done. When he learned, possibly from Lindemann, that he could keep his patents secret only by assigning them to some appropriate agency of the British government, Szilard offered them first to the War Office. Director of Artillery J. Coombs turned them down on October 8th, noting that there appears to be no reason to keep the specification secret so far as the War Department is concerned. If Lindemann heard of the rejection, he must have remembered his own rejection by the Army in 1915. The following February, 1936, he intervened on Szilard's behalf with the Admiralty, Churchill's old bailiwick, writing the head of the Department of Scientific Research and Development, cannily, "I dare say you remember my ringing you up about a man working here who had a patent which he thought ought to be kept secret. I enclose a letter from him on the subject as you suggested. I'm naturally somewhat less optimistic about the prospects than the inventor, but he is a very good physicist, and even if the chances were 100 to 1 against, it seems to me it might be worth keeping the thing secret, as it is not going to cost the government anything. The patent, Szilard explained in the letter Lindemann enclosed, contains information which could be used in the construction of explosive bodies, very many thousand times more powerful than ordinary bombs. He was concerned about the disasters which could be caused by their use on the part of certain powers which might attack this country. Wisely, and withal inexpensively, the Admiralty accepted the patent into its safekeeping. 8 months in Copenhagen had suited Edward Teller. He met George Gamow on the Odessen's last visit there, after the Solvay conference of the previous autumn. The two of them roared across Denmark and back during Easter vacation on Gamow's motorcycle, working over a problem in quantum mechanics. The Rockefeller Foundation did not approve of marriage during a fellowship period, but James Franck had interceded on his behalf, and Teller had married his childhood sweetheart, Michi Harkanyi, in Budapest on February 26th. He had also written an important paper. He returned to London with Michi in the summer of 1934 with his reputation enhanced and again took up his lectureship at University College. Assuming they would settle in England, the Tellers signed a 9-year lease just before Christmas on a pleasant 3-room flat. 2 offers arrived in January, one of which changed Teller's mind. The first was from Princeton, a lectureship. The second was from Gamow, a full professorship at George Washington University. GWU wanted to strengthen its physics department. Gamow wanted company and liked Teller's verve. Teller was 26 years old and a newlywed. He was less than sure about living in the United States, but a full professorship was not something he could sensibly refuse. His wife found someone to sublet the flat. The U.S. State Department refused non-quota immigration visas because Teller had only taught for 1 year, the Copenhagen time counted merely as a fellowship, and was required to have taught for 2. He had not, however, tried for visas on the Hungarian immigration quota because he assumed the quota was full. In fact, there was room. The Tellers followed the Gamows across the Atlantic in August 1935. Niels Bohr celebrated his 50th birthday on October 7th. Bohr in those days seemed at the height of his powers, bodily and mentally, Otto Frisch observes. When he thundered up the steep staircase of the Institute 2 steps at a time, there were few of us younger ones that could keep pace with him. The peace of the library was often broken by a brisk game of ping-pong, and I don't remember ever beating Bohr at that game. To honor Denmark's leading physicist, George de Hevesy organized a fundraising campaign. The Danish people contributed 100,000 kroner to buy Bohr 0.6 gram of radium for his birthday. De Hevesy divided the radium in liquid solution into 6 equal parts, mixed each with beryllium powder, and allowed them to dry, making 6 potent neutron sources. He had them mounted on the ends of long rods and stored them in a dry well in the basement of the Institute that had been dug originally to supply vibration-free housing for a spectrograph. The Institute's annual Christmas party continued to be held in the well room, Stefan Rosenthal recalls. The lid of the well served as a table, a Christmas tree stood in the middle, and all the personnel were gathered, from the chief down to the youngest apprentice in the workshop, and served a modest meal of sausages and beer. During the party, Niels Bohr used to make a speech in which he gave a sort of survey of the past year. Safely below the sausages, stuck in a gallon flask of carbon disulfide, the neutron sources silently transmuted sulfur to radioactive phosphorus for de Hevesy's biological radioisotope studies. Bohr had won national distinction for his work, and the enduring gratitude of refugees for his aid. He had also faced personal pain. In 1932, the Danish Academy offered him lifetime free occupancy of the Danish House of Honor, a palatial estate in Pompeian style, built originally for the founder of Carlsberg Breweries and subsequently reserved for Denmark's most distinguished citizen. Knud Rasmussen, the polar explorer, was its previous occupant. By then, the institute buildings included a modest director's house, but the Bohrs shared it with five handsome sons. They moved to the mansion beside the brewery, the best address in Denmark, after the king's. 2 years later, an accident took the Bohrs' eldest son, Christian, 19 years old. Father, son, and two friends were sailing in the Øresund, the sea passage between Denmark and Sweden, when a squall blew up. Christian was drowned by falling overboard in a very rough sea from a sloop, Robert Oppenheimer reports, and Bohr circled as long as there was light, looking for him. But the Øresund is cold. For a time, Bohr retreated into grief. Exhausting as it was, the refugee turmoil helped him. Everyone at the Institute followed Fermi's neutron work with fascination. Frisch, the only physicist on hand who knew Italian, was drafted to translate the successive papers aloud as soon as each issue of the Ricerca Scientifica arrived. The Copenhagen group was puzzled that slow neutrons affected some elements more intensely than others. On the one-particle model of the nucleus, even a slow neutron should almost always shoot completely through a nucleus without capture. From Cornell, Hans Bethe published a paper calculating the slim odds of neutron capture. They conflicted squarely with observation. Frisch remembers the colloquium in Copenhagen in 1935 when someone reported on Bethe's paper. On that occasion, Bohr kept interrupting, and I was beginning to wonder, with some irritation, why he didn't let the speaker finish. Then, in the middle of a sentence, Bohr suddenly stopped and sat down, his face completely dead. We looked at him for several seconds, getting anxious. Had he been taken unwell? But then he suddenly got up and said, with an apologetic smile, "Now I understand it." What Bohr understood about the nucleus he embodied in a landmark lecture to the Danish Academy on January 27, 1936, subsequently published in Nature. "Neutron capture and nuclear constitution exploited the phenomenon of neutron capture to propose a new model of the nucleus. Once again, as he had with Rutherford's planetary model of the atom, Bohr stood on the solid ground of experiment to argue for radical theoretical change. He visualized a nucleus made up of neutrons and protons closely packed together, a model now familiar, rather than a single particle. Nuclear particles collectively are known as nucleons. A neutron entering such a crowded nucleus would not pass through, it would collide with the nearest nucleons, surrender its kinetic energy, as a cue ball does at break in billiards, and be captured by the strong force that holds the nucleus together. The energy added by the neutron would agitate the nearby nucleons. They would collide in turn with other nucleons beyond. The net effect would be a more generally agitated, hotter nucleus, but one where no single component could quickly acquire enough energy to push through the electrical barrier and escape. If the nucleus then radiated its excess energy by ejecting a gamma photon, cooling off, none of its nucleons could accrue enough energy to escape. The result, already confirmed by Fermi's experiments, would be the creation of a heavier isotope of the original element being bombarded. More violent assaults on the nucleus, Bohr thought, would still disperse their energies throughout the compound nucleus created by their capture. Subsequent reconcentration of the energy might allow the nucleus to eject several charged or uncharged particles. Bohr did not think his compound model of the nucleus boded well for harnessing nuclear energy. For still more violent impacts, with particles of energies of about 1,000 million volts, we must even be prepared for the collision to lead to an explosion of the whole nucleus. Not only are such energies, of course, at present far beyond the reach of experiments, but it does not need to be stressed that such effects would scarcely bring us any nearer to the solution of the much-discussed problem of releasing the nuclear energy for practical purposes. Indeed, the more our knowledge of nuclear reactions advances, the remoter this goal seems to become. Thus, by the mid-1930s, the three most original living physicists had each spoken to the question of harnessing nuclear energy. Rutherford had dismissed it as moonshine. Einstein had compared it to shooting in the dark at scarce birds. Bohr thought it remote in direct proportion to understanding. If they seem less perceptive in their skepticism than Szilard, they also had a better grasp of the odds. The essential future is always unforeseen. They were experienced enough not to long for it. In his lecture, Bohr preferred to state only general principles, but to trace the consequences of the general argument here developed. He had a specific mathematical model in mind. He published a discussion of that model the following year, in 1937. It reached all the way back to his doctoral dissertation on the surface tension of fluids to demonstrate the usefulness of treating the atomic nucleus as if it were a liquid drop. The tendency of molecules to stick together gives liquids a skin of surface tension. A falling raindrop thus rounds itself into a small, perfect sphere. But any force acting on a liquid drop deforms it. Think of the wobbles of a water-filled balloon thrown into the air and caught. Surface tension and deforming forces work against each other in complex ways. The molecules of the liquid bump and collide. The drop wobbles and distorts. Eventually, the added energy dissipates as heat, and the drop steadies again. The nucleus, Bohr proposed, was similar. The force that stuck the nucleons together was the nuclear strong force. Counteracting that strong force was the common electrical repulsion of the positively charged nuclear protons. The delicate balance between the two fundamental forces made the nucleus liquid-like. Energy added from the outside by particle bombardment deformed it. It wobbled like a liquid drop, oscillating complexly, just as the braided streams of water Bohr had studied for his dissertation had oscillated. Which meant he could use Rayleigh's classical formula for the surface tension of liquids to understand the complex nuclear energy levels and exchanges that Fermi's work had revealed. This 1937 paper had to close with many issues not cleared up, writes the American theoretical physicist John Archibald Wheeler, who helped Bohr clear up more of them later. The liquid drop model proved useful, however, and Frisch in Copenhagen and Meitner in Berlin, among others, took it to heart. One fine October Thursday in 1937, Ernest Rutherford, a vigorous 66, went out into the garden of his house on the green Cambridge backs to trim a tree. He took a bad fall. He was seedy later in the day, Mary Rutherford said, nausea and indigestion, and she arranged for a masseur. Rutherford vomited that night. In the morning, he called his family doctor. He suffered from a slight umbilical hernia, which he confined with a truss. His doctor found a possible strangulation, consulted with a specialist, and directed the Rutherfords to the Evelyn Nursing Home for emergency surgery. Rutherford told his wife along the way that his business and financial affairs were all in order. She said his illness wasn't serious and asked him not to worry. Surgery that evening confirmed a partial strangulation, released the imprisoned portion of the small intestine, and restored its circulation. Saturday, Rutherford seemed to be recovering, but he began vomiting again on Sunday, and there were signs of infection, deadly in those days before antibiotics. Monday, he was worse. His doctors consulted the surgeon, a Melbourne man, who advised against a second operation, given the patient's age and symptoms. Rutherford was made comfortable with intravenous saline, 6 pints by Tuesday, and a stomach tube. Tuesday morning, October 19th, he was slightly improved, but though his wife judged him a wonderful patient who bears his discomfort splendidly and believed she discovered just a thread of hope. He began that afternoon to weaken. A bequest, he decided late in the day, suggests he found gratitude in those last hours reviewing his life. "I want to leave £100 to Nelson College," he told Mary Rutherford. "You can see to it." And again, loudly, a little later, "Remember, £100 to Nelson College." He died that evening. Heart and circulation failed because of massive infection, his doctor wrote, and the end came peacefully. An international gathering of physicists in Bologna that week celebrated the 200th anniversary of the birth of Luigi Galvani. Cambridge cabled the news of Rutherford's death on the morning of October 20th. Bohr was on hand and accepted the grim duty of announcement. "When the meeting scheduled for that morning assembled," writes Mark Oliphant, "Bohr went to the front, and with faltering voice and tears in his eyes, informed the gathering of what had happened. They were shocked at the abruptness of the loss. Bohr had visited Rutherford at Cambridge a few weeks earlier. The Cavendish men had seen their leader in fine fettle only days ago. Bohr spoke from the heart," says Oliphant, recalling the debt which science owed so great a man whom he was privileged to call both his master and his friend. "For Oliphant, it was one of the most moving experiences of my life." Remembering Rutherford in a letter to Oppenheimer on December 20th, Bohr balanced loss with hope, complementarily. "Life is poorer without him, but still every thought about him will be a lasting encouragement." And in 1958, in a memorial lecture, Bohr said simply that, "To me, he had almost been as a second father." The sub-dean of Westminster immediately approved interment of Rutherford's ashes in the nave of Westminster Abbey, just west of Newton's tomb, and in line with Kelvin's. Eulogizing Rutherford at a conference in Calcutta the following January, James Jeans identified his place in the history of science. "Voltaire said once that Newton was far more fortunate than any other scientist could ever be, since it could fall to only one man to discover the laws which governed the universe. Had he lived in a later age, he might have said something similar of Rutherford and the realm of the infinitely small. For Rutherford was the Newton of atomic physics." Ernest Rutherford unknowingly wrote his own, more characteristic epitaph in a letter to A.S. Eve from his country cottage on the first day of that last October. He reported of his garden what he had also done for physics, vigorous and generous work. "I have made a still further clearance of the blackberry patch, and the view is now quite attractive." In September 1934, in the wake of Fermi's June Nature article, "Possible Production of Elements of Atomic Number Higher than 92, a curious paper appeared in a publication seldom read by physicists, the Zeitschrift für Angewandte Chemie, the Journal of Applied Chemistry. Its author was a respected German chemist, Ida Noddack, co-discoverer with her husband in 1925 of the hard platinum-white metallic element rhenium, atomic number 75. The paper was titled simply On Element 93, and it severely criticized Fermi's work. His method of proof was not valid, Noddack wrote bluntly. He had demonstrated that his new beta emitter was not protactium, and then distinguished it from several other elements descending down the periodic table to lead, but it was not clear why he chose to stop at lead. The old view that the radioactive elements form a continuous series beginning at uranium and ending at lead, wrote Noddack, was exactly what the Joliot-Curie's discovery of artificial radioactivity had disproved. Fermi, therefore, ought to have compared his new radio element with all known elements. The fact was, Noddack went on, any number of elements could be precipitated out of uranium nitrate with manganese. Instead of assuming the production of a new transuranic element, one could assume equally well that when neutrons are used to produce nuclear disintegrations, some distinctly new nuclear reactions take place, which have not been observed previously. In the past, elements have transmuted only into their near neighbors, but when heavy nuclei are bombarded by neutrons, it is conceivable that the nucleus breaks up into several large fragments, which would, of course, be isotopes of known elements, but would not be neighbors. They would be, rather, much lighter elements farther down the periodic table than lead. Segre remembers reading the Nodak paper. He knows, because he asked them, that Hahn in Berlin and Joliot in Paris read it. It made very little sense to anyone.
"I think whatever chemists read it," Frisch reminisces, "probably thought that this was quite pointless, carping criticism, and the physicists possibly even more so if they read it, because they would say, what's the use of criticizing unless you give some reason why that criticism would be valid?"
Nobody had ever found a nuclear disintegration creating far-removed elements, which was a point Nodak had carefully addressed, but was clearly one reason for the paper's neglect. The summary report for Nature on artificial radioactivity that Amaldi and Segre had delivered to Rutherford in mid-summer 1934 makes the assumption explicit. It is reasonable to assume that the atomic number of the active element should be close to the atomic number of the bombarded element. But Fermi seldom left anything to assumption, however reasonable. He would certainly not have left to assumption this issue, about which he was already acutely sensitive because of Corbino's ill-timed speech. Nodak rubbed salt into that wound by referring to the reports found in the newspapers. He sat down and performed the necessary calculations. He later told at least Teller, Segre, and his American protege Leona Woods that he had done so. Teller is quite sure he knows what those calculations were. Fermi refused to believe Nodak. He knew how to calculate whether or not uranium could break in two. He performed the calculation, Mrs. Nodak suggested, and found that the probability was extraordinarily low. He concluded that Mrs. Nodak's suggestion could not possibly be correct, so he forgot about it. His theory was right, but it was based on the wrong experimental information. Here, Teller indicts Aston's measurement of the mass of helium, the same that misled Szilard to beryllium, which introduced a systematic error into calculating the mass and energy of nuclei. Segre finds Teller's version of the story possible, but not persuasive. The helium mass number problem would not necessarily have ruled out breaking up the uranium nucleus. You know, occasionally Fermi would tell you things, then you asked him, "But really, how? Show me." And then he would say, "Oh, well, I know this on CIF." He spoke Italian. CIF meant con intuito formidabile, with formidable intuition. So how he did it, I don't know. On the other hand, Fermi made a lot of calculations which he kept to himself. Leona Woods' version sheds light on Teller's. Why was Dr. Nodak's suggestion ignored? The reason is that she was ahead of her time. Bohr's liquid drop model of the nucleus had not yet been formulated, and so there was at hand no accepted way to calculate whether breaking up into several large fragments was energetically allowed. If Nodak's physics was avant-garde, her chemistry was sound. By 1938, her article was gathering dust on back shelves, but Bohr had promulgated the liquid drop model of the nucleus, and the confused chemistry of uranium increasingly preoccupied Lise Meitner and Otto Hahn. 9. An extensive burst. I believe all young people think about how they would like their lives to develop. Lise Meitner wrote in old age, looking back. When I did so, I always arrived at the conclusion that life need not be easy, provided only that it was not empty. And this wish I have been granted. 60 years old in 1938, the Austrian physicist had earned wide respect by hard and careful work. When Wolfgang Pauli had wished to propose an elusive, almost massless neutral particle to explain the energy that seemed to disappear in beta decay, it came to be called the neutrino, he had made his proposal in a letter to Lise Meitner and Hans Geiger. James Chadwick was quite convinced that she would have discovered the neutron if it had been firmly in her mind, if she had had the advantage of, say, living in the Cavendish for years, as I had done. Slight in figure and shy by nature, as her nephew Otto Frisch describes her, she was nevertheless formidable. During the Great War, she had volunteered as an X-ray technician with the Austrian army. There, says Frisch, she had to cope with streams of injured Polish soldiers, not understanding their language, and with her medical bosses who interfered with her work, not understanding X-rays. She arranged her leaves from duty to coincide with Otto Hahn's and hurried to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Chemistry in Dahlem to work with him. That was when they identified the element next down from uranium that they named protactinium. After the war, she did physics separately until 1934, when, challenged by Fermi's work, she persuaded Otto Hahn to renew our direct collaboration to explore the consequences of bombarding uranium with neutrons. Meitner headed the physics department at the Institute then, of which Hahn had become the director. She had attained, by middle age, Hahn remarks fondly, not only the dignity of a German professor, but also one of his proverbial attributes— absent-mindedness. At a scientific gathering, a male colleague greeted her by saying, "We met on an earlier occasion." Not remembering that earlier occasion, she replied in all seriousness, "You probably mistake me for Professor Hahn." Hahn supposed she was thinking of the many papers they had published together. If she hid her shyness behind formidable reserve, among friends, Frisch says, she could be lively and cheerful and an excellent storyteller. Her nephew thought her totally lacking in vanity. She wore her thick, dark hair, now graying, pulled back and coiled in a bun, and her youthful beauty had muted to bright but darkly circled eyes, a thin mouth, a prominent nose. She ate lightly, but drank quantities of strong coffee. Music moved her. She followed it, as other people follow trends and fashions in art, a family cultivation. Her sister, Frisch's mother, was a concert pianist. She made a duet at the piano on visits with her musical nephew, though hardly anybody else knew that she could play. She lived in an apartment at the KWI, and when there was time, she took long walks, 10 miles or more a day. "It keeps me young and alert." Her most holy commitment, Frisch thought, the vision she never lost that filled her life, was of physics as a battle for final truth. The truth she battled for through the later 30s was hidden somewhere in the complexities of uranium. She and Hahn, and beginning in 1935, a young German chemist named Fritz Strassmann, worked to sort out all the substances into which the heaviest of natural elements transmuted under neutron bombardment. By early 1938, they had identified no fewer than 10 different half-life activities, many more than Fermi had demonstrated in his first pioneering survey. They assumed the substances must be either isotopes of uranium or transuranics. For Hahn, says Frisch, it was like the old days, when new elements fell like apples when you shook the tree. But Lise Meitner found the energetic reactions necessary to produce such new elements unexpected and increasingly hard to explain. Meanwhile, Irene Curie had begun looking into uranium with a visiting Yugoslav, Pavel Savic. They described a 3.5-hour activity the Germans had not reported and suggested it might be thorium, element 90, with which Curie had years of experience. If true, the Curie-Savic suggestion would mean that a slow neutron somehow acquired the energy to knock an energetic alpha particle out of the uranium nucleus. The KWI trio scoffed. looking for the 3.5-hour activity, failed to find it, and wrote the Radium Institute suggesting a public retraction. The French team identified the activity again and discovered they could separate it from their uranium by carrier chemistry using lanthanum, element 57, a rare earth. They proposed, therefore, that it must either be actinium, element 89, chemically similar to lanthanum, but even harder than thorium to explain, or else a new and mysterious element. Either way, their findings called the KWI work into doubt. Hahn met Joliot in May at a chemistry congress in Rome and told the Frenchman cordially but frankly that he was skeptical of Curie's discovery and intended to repeat her experiment and expose her error. By then, as Joliot undoubtedly knew, his wife had already raised the stakes, had tried to separate the actinium from its lanthanum carrier, and had found it would not separate. No one imagined the substance could actually be lanthanum. How could a slow neutron transmute uranium into a much lighter rare earth 34 places down the periodic table? It seems, Curie and Savitch reported that May in the Compte Rendu, that this substance cannot be anything except a transuranic element, possessing very different properties from those of other known transuranics, a hypothesis which raises great difficulties for its interpretation. In the course of this exotic debate, Meitner's status changed. Adolf Hitler bullied the young Chancellor of Austria to a meeting at the German dictator's Berchtesgaden retreat in Bavaria in mid-February. "Who knows?" Hitler threatened him. "Perhaps I shall be suddenly overnight in Vienna, like a spring storm." On March 14th, he was, triumphantly parading. The day before, with the raw new German Wehrmacht occupying its capital, Austria had proclaimed itself a province of the Third Reich, and its most notorious native son had wept for joy. The Anschluss, the annexation, made Meitner a German citizen, to whom all the ugly anti-Semitic laws applied that the Nazi state had been accumulating since 1933. The years of the Hitler regime were naturally very depressing, she wrote near the end of her life. But work was a good friend, and I have often thought and said how wonderful it is that by work one may be granted a long respite of forgetfulness from oppressive political conditions. After the spring storm of the Anschluss, her grant was abruptly withdrawn. Max von Laue sought her out then. He had heard that Heinrich Himmler, head of the Nazi SS and chief of German police, had issued an order forbidding the emigration of any more academics. Meitner feared she might be expelled from the KWI and left unemployed and exposed. She made contact with Dutch colleagues, including Dirk Koster, the physicist who had worked in Copenhagen with George de Hevesy in 1922 to discover hafnium. The Dutchman persuaded their government to admit Meitner to Holland without a visa, on a passport that was nothing more now than a sad souvenir. Koster traveled to Berlin on Friday, July 16th, arriving in the evening, and went straight to Dahlem to the KWI. The editor of Naturwissenschaften, Paul Rosbaud, an old friend, showed up as well, and together with Hahn, the men spent the night helping Meitner pack. "I gave her a beautiful diamond ring," Hahn remembers, "that I had inherited from my mother, and which I had never worn myself, but always treasured. I wanted her to be provided for in an emergency." Meitner left with Koster by train on Saturday morning. 9 years later, she remembered the grim passage, as if she had traveled alone. "I took a train for Holland on the pretext that I wanted to spend a week's vacation. At the Dutch border, I got the scare of my life when a Nazi military patrol of 5 men going through the coaches picked up my Austrian passport, which had expired long ago. I got so frightened, my heart almost stopped beating. I knew that the Nazis had just declared open season on Jews, that the hunt was on. For 10 minutes I sat there and waited, 10 minutes that seemed like so many hours. Then one of the Nazi officials returned and handed me back the passport without a word. 2 minutes later, I descended on Dutch territory, where I was met by some of my Holland colleagues. She was safe, then. She moved on to Copenhagen for the emotional renewal of rest at the Carlsberg House of Honor with the Boers. Moore had found a place for her in Sweden, at the Physical Institute of the Academy of Sciences on the outskirts of Stockholm, a thriving laboratory directed by Carl Mann George Siekmann, the 1924 Physics Nobel laureate for work in X-ray spectroscopy. The Nobel Foundation provided a grant. She traveled to that far northern exile, to a country where she had neither the language nor many friends, as if to prison. Leo Szilard was looking for a patron. Frederick Lindemann had arranged an ICI fellowship for him at Oxford beginning in 1935, and for a while Szilard worked there. But the possibility of war in Europe made him restless. From Oxford in late March 1936, he had written to Gertrude Weiss in Vienna that she should consider emigrating to America. He appears to have applied his reasoning to his own case as well. Szilard had met Weiss in his Berlin years and subsequently advised and quietly courted her. Now she had graduated from medical school. At his invitation, she came to Oxford to see him. They walked in the country. She photographed him standing at roadside before a weathered log barrier, rounding at 38, but not yet rotund, with a budding young tree filigreed behind him. He told me he would be surprised if one could work in Vienna in 2 years. He said Hitler would be there. And he was. The Anschluss. Almost to the day. Szilard had written in his letter that England was a very likable country, but it would certainly be a lot smarter if you went to America. In America, you would be a free human being, and very soon would not even be a stranger. Weiss went, and stayed to become a distinguished expert in public health, and, late in their wandering years, Szilard's wife. During the same period, Szilard wrote Michael Polanyi. He would stay in England until 1 year before the war, at which time I would shift my residence to New York City. The letter provoked comment, Szilard enjoyed recalling. It was very funny, because how can anyone say what he will do 1 year before the war? As it turned out, his prognostication was off by only 4 months. He arrived in the United States on January 2nd, 1938. Before then, Szilard had located a possible patron there, a Jewish financier of Virginia background named Louis Lichtenstein Strauss, his first and middle names honoring his East Prussian maternal grandfather, his last name softened in Southern fashion to Strauss. 42 years old in 1938, Louis Strauss was a full partner at the New York investment banking house Kuhn Loeb, a self-made millionaire, an adaptable, clever, but thin-skinned and pompous man. Strauss had dreamed as a boy of becoming a physicist. The recession of 1913-14 had staggered his family's Richmond business, wholesale shoes, and his father had called on him, at 17, to drum a four-state territory. He did well. By 1917, he had saved $20,000 and was once again preparing to pursue a physics career. This time, the Great War intervened. A childhood accident had left Strauss with marginal vision in one eye. His mother doted on him. She allowed his younger brother to volunteer for military service, but looked for some less dangerous contribution for her favorite son. It turned up when Woodrow Wilson appointed the celebrated mining engineer and Belgian relief administrator Herbert Hoover as food administrator to manage U.S. supplies during the war. The wealthy Hoover was serving in Washington without pay and assembling a prosperous